So hello everyone and welcome to the Leiterpach Centre for International Law and the Friday lunchtime lectures, which are kindly sponsored by Cambridge University Press. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Professor Finula Nyalane. Professor Nyalane is Regents Professor and Rabina Professor of Law, Public Policy and Society at the University of Minnesota Law School, as well as Professor of Law at the Queen's University Belfast. She is also the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the protection and promotion of human rights while countering terrorism, a position she has held since 2017. And she's been doing hugely important and influential work in that capacity, and I would highly encourage you to read her reports. She's also published extensively in the fields of emergency powers, counterterrorism and human rights, conflict regulation, transitional justice, and sex-based violence in times of war. Today, she will be speaking on the topic, where does counterterrorism go next, 20 years after 9/11? She will speak for approximately 20, 25 minutes, which means that we will have plenty of time for questions and discussion at the end. You can type in your question in the Q&A box, which you can find at the bottom of your screen, as it occurs to you, so you don't need to wait until the end to type in your question. So Finula, a very warm welcome, and the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good morning from New York. We're getting close to being able to do these things in person, but it's still nonetheless really nice to be joining you. I'm joining you just after my interactive dialogue, which happened yesterday at the General Assembly, and it is the 20th year of the anniversary of the events of 9/11. And so this is a very appropriate time to ask some very fundamental questions about where counterterrorism goes next. Not only prompted by that, in some ways, sort of anniversary moment, but also prompted by the events of the last couple of months in Afghanistan, in the context where we are now seeing, in some sense, the place where so many of the counterterrorism policies that defined the past 20 years had their birth. And now we find ourselves in a situation with a de facto government of Afghanistan, the Taliban, which is on a, many of its members who sit on a UN designated terrorism list. And so that leaves us, to say the least, in a thorny situation as to how we manage the legacy and the practicalities of counterterrorism in this new world, particularly in the Afghan context. So it's important to say, maybe to say, in order to go forward, we have to understand where we came from. And so I'm going to do a little bit of charting as to the universe of CT that I see since 9/11, because I think understanding both the normative and institutional frameworks that have defined counterterrorism in the last 20 years give us some clues as to what's coming next. So quite literally, as the dust was settling in the, and the ashes were smoldering on the Twin Towers in New York, up the street, the Security Council met very quickly the day after the events of 9/11. And a series of resolutions were passed in that September, the most important of which, for our purposes, is UN Security Council Resolution 1373. This was in many ways a really unique piece of Security Council work. It's important to note that, of course, the Security Council's expansion of what constituted a threat to global peace and security had been steadily expanding since the end of the Cold War. So that's not a per se new phenomena. We'd seen it move into issues of child's rights, protection of civilians. We'd seen it move into systemic human rights violations. And we'd also seen country-specific situations emerge with more frequency in specific ways as a threat to regional peace, regional and national, international peace and security. But one of the things that happened in that resolution was the definition of terrorism in a very specific way as a threat to global peace and security. But terrorism absent a definition. And this key point that our global counterterrorism work since 9/11 has been based on a universe which lacks a definition of the phenomena which is being regulated. speaks to some of the core, both rule of law in the sense of clarity and precision of law challenges in this area, but also speaks to what we might call the slipperiness of this area and the way in which it's been able to move and settle itself in unexpected and expansionist ways. So UN Security Council Resolution 1373 has been defined by some, including myself, as a super legislative resolution, because it required states to do some very specific things in their domestic legal systems, requiring states to criminalize terrorism with no provision on what that definition would be, requiring states to regulate on the countering of terrorism finance, requiring states to ensure that no safe harbor was given to anyone who might be considered a terrorist. And if you want another thread of this, the one thread is like the lack of definition. But the second thread is the speed and scale and the consistency of Security Council resolutions on counterterrorism since that September 2001 resolution. And it's worth noting that one of the reasons why we've seen such activity and consensus in this area is because, of course, it's a little bit like motherhood and an apple pie. Everyone agrees that terrorism is a bad thing. And terrorism was the one sure place where you could consistently get Security Council members to agree on the work they would do, all the more so because it had the glorious constructive ambiguity of not having a definition. So the two things are connected. That sort of phrase, I'm going to say more about the expansion of the normative framework, but I want to note the lock-in of that normative work that was done in CT from the very beginning and the importance of normative frameworks. And the start of that normative framework is the opening up to doing more. The third trend I want to talk about, so one is definitions, the second is this normative space, and the third is institutions. So one of the things that's embedded into UN Security Council Resolution 1373 is the creation of a new counterterrorism architecture at the United Nations itself. And often, as an international lawyer, it often surprises me that, you know, we teach, and I say this having come to being Special Rapporteur, we teach international law traditionally through the, and we think of the Security Council and the United Nations. And we often, I think, as scholars and practitioners, tend to describe the Security Council, at least in its past 20 years, as a sort of a dysfunctional place, a place where it's really hard to get business done. It's hard to get business done. We can't get a resolution on Syria. There are things we simply cannot do on the council. But one of the things that actually elides is the extent to which the architecture, the counterterrorism architecture that's been built in the Security Council is actually a highly effective, highly functional space where states have been doing consistent, consensus-based work over the past 20 years. So let me talk a little bit about what that architecture looks like. So in Security Council Resolution 1373, we saw the establishment of a counterterrorism committee, CTC, which is of course the Security Council in miniature. It was then in 2004, we saw the addition of a special political mission, a body called UNCTED, the Counterterrorism Executive Directorate, which is like a permanent civil service to the Security Council apparatus on counterterrorism. And one of the reasons why that apparatus is so important is, of course, clear that Security Council does work in a whole range of areas, but none of it is attached to a full-time body of experts whose job it is to ensure that these things get mainlined and streamlined through national legislation and the national work of states through technical assistance and capacity building. So the establishment of this architecture actually created ways that I view as unique, as a normative and structural matter, to actually create a highway of regulation of counterterrorism directly into national legal systems, which doesn't really exist for any parallel area, maybe slightly on sanctions, which is an issue I'll come to in a minute. But that establishment of the CTC and UN CTED created these invisible but highly powerful sub-entities within one a subsidiary body, the other a special political mission, which essentially ensured the kind of mechanism to empower, enable, and entrench the kind of normative progressions that would be made on the council. And there's a loop here, meaning that it was in the interest of this special political entity, UN CTED, to actually anything, UN bodies love to take up more space. They're kind of they're created to be expansionist in a way. It's a dynamic of the system, of it's a dynamic of both the political mechanisms, but also of the kind of dynamics of institutional power within the United Nations, that you know you create an unvirtuous circle here, because the more CT that gets done by the Security Council, the more this body has to do, the more resources it has, the more standing and empowerment it has, and then the more the Security Council relies on it. So this is a really important cycle. I will say that one of the things that my both scholarly and policy work has focused on is acknowledging the extent to which this new architectural space created after 9/11 was a human rights free zone. The first chair of the UN seat of the the UK was the chair of the CTC in its first outing, and Sir Jeremy Greenstock famously declared that human rights didn't have a place in this architecture. This was a security space. Human rights was over there. And counterterrorism was a space where human rights really didn't have a seat at the table. And that was structurally built in, both normatively and institutionally, from the very beginning. There's one passing reference to human rights in UN Security Council 1373. When UN CTED was established, there was no human rights expertise built into it. And it has been, as I'll talk about more in a couple of minutes, notoriously difficult for UN human rights experts and also civil society, any stakeholders that would have stuff to say about the rule of law and human rights, to gain access to this space. It is largely a sealed security space, with little access by those actors who might have something to say about the impacts of this architecture. Let me just say a brief note about sanctions, because in parallel to this sort of CT space, there's a connected space, which is the sanctions regime. And it has led to the emergence of what Gavin Sullivan in a recent book has described as the law of the list, where listing became one of the preferred mechanisms of states to manage their counterterrorism and security problems. Listing, of course, was not a post 9/11 phenomenon. Pre 9/11, in 1999, the Security Council, again acting under Chapter 7 of the Charter, passed UN Security Council Resolution 1267. And that designated the Taliban as a terrorist organization because of its refusal to transfer Osama bin Laden and his associates following the terrorist attacks on US embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Of course, that 1267 system and its attached system, the 1989 system, which emerged during the as a response to the fact that there was a negotiated process happening in Afghanistan, which required people to come off one list and not be on other lists, was a core piece of the kind of tools that the Security Council had to regulate global counterterrorism challenges. Now, again, I want to say we see an architecture, we see two things in this space, a normative architecture, which is Security Council resolutions around listing, which have been famously challenged, the Caddy case being the sort of obvious decision, famously challenged for their failure to adhere to due process and fairness norms. And of course, again, the motif of this space has been the establishment of institutional spaces. So along with the resolutions went the 1267 monitoring team. Again, a group of experts who report to the Security Council on threat identification and the ongoing use of these sanctions. Again, just underscoring, this was a human rights light, non-transparent space. Famously, of course, as I've mentioned, it was challenged through the CADI decision. The CADI decision led to the establishment of a UN ombudsman for the 1267 list. That ombudsperson, we've had three highly distinguished jurists in that space. Each one of them has continued to report each year to the General Assembly and to the Council on the failure to ensure due process protections in this space and their underlying concerns about a lack of fairness, a lack of transparency, and fundamentally the inability for individuals who have been designated as terrorists on these lists to either get a fair hearing or ever come off the list. And it's perhaps notable that the current ombudsman resigned his post in protest this summer at the consistent failure of the Security Council to address the ongoing concerns about the functioning of those lists. Okay, so that's the Security Council piece. But the Security Council, of course, didn't sit in isolation from other parts of the system. And on the General Assembly side of the House in 2005, we saw the establishment of what was kind of a loose cooperative framework, CIFTF, which was intended to bring together UN entities working on the, you know, on the General Assembly side of the House to engage on CT. I'm not going to go through the history between 2005. The international administrative lawyers among us might take interest in that. And there's much to say, particularly about the production of soft law norms in this space in that intervening period. But by 2017, on this side of the House, we see a major revamp of counterterrorism at the UN. And that revamp comes in the form of the establishment of an Office of Counterterrorism under a new Undersecretary General, Mr. Vladimir Voronkov. It should be noted that we now have an Office of Counterterrorism. It's one of the fastest growing entities within the UN system. In 2017, it started with a footprint of 8 staff members. It's now at 147 and growing. And it's paid for by 2 states, the Kingdom of Qatar and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And some of us observe that you sort of get the kind of counterterrorism you pay for when you ask who's paying the bills for this structure. Key things about this architecture that I think are worth knowing. One is that it is accelerated in the last 4 years, its production of soft law norms. And I want to come back to the normative implications of what it means to have this large body of soft law coming out of the CT system. The second thing it has done, which is, I think, of significant concern to the kind of architectural balances of the United Nations, particularly the system of UN resident coordinators, which was established by the Secretary General to create reform and centralization and kind of what we might call both efficiencies, but one UN, is that the Office of Counterterrorism, supported by a number of states, has started to open up country offices around the world. Those country offices are intended to provide what I see as a service-oriented model of assistance to states. And we'll come back to what that means in terms of the practice of counterterrorism and its interface, particularly with authoritarian governance and rule of law deficits at national level. So that's UN, or a glimpse of what's happening in the UN system over the past 20 years. In parallel, though, I want to say that we've seen this isn't happening in isolation from other trends. And the other trends have been the massive growth, unprecedented growth, of informal institutions in the counterterrorism arena in multiple ways. I want to just name a couple of them and talk about their influence on both the corpus of international law as well as the impact on multilateralism when states who cannot get what they want in security or counterterrorism terms at the United Nations actually go out and create their own clubs to get what they want in other places. So we've had a number of these self-selected clubs emerge in the last two decades. One predates 9/11, which is the FATF, the Financial Action Task Force, the most important international law body most of us don't look at very much because it doesn't seem as significant as the work that happens in formal, it's a formal institutional space, but in a less obvious institutional space. The FATF, of course, was set up to establish corruption or address corruption, but has really been repurposed as the primary body that does counterterrorism work and looks at the countering terrorism finance space. Now, again, bear in mind that we don't have agreed definitions of terrorism. So when states get to define terrorism as they want on their own domestic terms, then the work that the Countering Terrorism Finance FATF does is largely dependent on national legal definitions. And what that, in my view, has resulted in has been the consistent misuse of countering terrorism finance legislation, primarily to attack civil society, dissenters, those who happen to be conveniently tagged as terrorists by states who find that they would like to find innovative and largely administrative ways to curtail their civil society and political dissent within their regimes. FATF is an odd international body. It has unclear legal standing, but one of its most important and I think concerning developments has been again the production of soft law norms. And maybe to just step out of a, you know, step back straight into my draw on my special rapporteur experiences. Often when I go to visit countries, of course, pre-COVID, and I would talk to states about their countering terrorism finance obligations, and I would talk to them about treaties. And they would tell me that they were implementing recommendation 8 of the FATF norms. And I would say, but actually you have a treaty norm. So one of the really interesting things here, and I think of Ayel Benvenisti's work in particular on soft and hard norms and the ways in which we see the kind of repurposing of so-called soft into hard norms. And I have an article forthcoming in the European Journal of International Law precisely on this, the practice of soft law practices in the CT space, focusing in particular on what's happening with the FATF. And what I would say is that we see a real, an extraordinary preference which has emerged in the CT space over the past two decades to lean into soft law, that soft becomes hard because it is for many reasons far more convenient and opportune for states and they can create those norms in the way they want to. So FATF is an example of this phenomenon. I don't have time today to talk about others, but I do want to flag the Global Counterterrorism Forum established by Turkey and the United States in 2011, celebrating its 10th anniversary today. Again, a self-selected club of states, which in many ways the US was not ambiguous about what it was going to do with GCTF. It made very clear that it thought the UN wasn't producing the kind of counterterrorism norms it wanted in the terms that the US wanted them. And they saw this forum as a way to go to act, to create the forum shop they could shop in to get the norms they wanted. And one of the things I've been documenting in the last couple of years is, again, an unvirtuous cycle where norms get produced in this GCTF are kind of gold plated there and then blue washed through the UN system, including through the UN Security Council, picked up in particular by those states who have a leading role, primarily the United States in GCTF. The other body that's worth a look, we don't have time today to talk about it, but it's the GIFCT, which is the body, the forum that was established initially as a private public partnership between internet communities and those working on CT. For those interested in issues of freedom of expression and content moderation, we see again the CT dialogues, but institutions in this space driving the ways in which discussions around content moderating are happening and how the responsibilities of states. And again, I want to make the clear link between highly oppressive authoritarian regimes who are really interested in content moderation and who find the imprimatur of terrorism and increasingly extremism as a really useful way to do that work. All right. I do want to say something about, so there's this universe of old bodies in the UN, multilateral bodies. We have these bodies, these new entities, these soft, informal entities. What Alejandro Rodríguez has beautifully described as coalitions of the willing coming together to do the work they want to do. And we also have private-public partnerships. So it's also clear that, you know, in this space of counterterrorism, there are clearly defined material and financial interests, both around, in particular, around technologies, but also around arms and around other important goods, if you want. And so we've seen GIFCT is a good example of that, of a private-public partnership that overlaps tech companies with CT work. But for example, a body called Tech Against Terrorism or the Biometric Institutes, which sits in London, these kind of quasi-think tank, quasi-private, quasi-governmental supported entities are doing an enormous amount of normative work. And that's really what I want to underscore, is the norm productions that come out of the norm production that comes out of these spaces is, in my view, having a really significant impact on the integrity of international law. Let me talk about national law, and then I'm going to go to over the horizon, which is the new American phrase for what happens next. And then we'll close and hopefully have time for questions. So what all of this has yielded at national level, I think, is, in my view, a systemic, structural and unrestrained ascendancy of CT as the kind of as the mode of choice for many states to engage in their governance work. And so a couple of things are happening. First, I want to just flag what's happening in legislative space. Because we have Chapter 7 resolutions that require states to legislate in a whole range of counterterrorism areas, that's translated into national law in the form of legislative practices. And because there's a body that checks if they've done it, which is the CTC and UNCTED, it has this kind of requirement of accountability that we see absent in so many other ways. So for example, if you were to compare what's happening in the Human Rights Treaty area with what's happening in the Chapter 7 Security Council resolutions on counterterrorism area, you see, because states report and are monitored on their CT obligations, and again, there's a little bit of forum shopping here, states are really concerned about being seen to be good CT actors, we see a high level of compliance. Now, compliance here isn't what human rights lawyers would say is human rights. It's compliance with the CT imperatives, which is increasing reach into national law of a range of legislative and other provisions on counterterrorism, extremism, and increasingly radicalization, which are the umbrella is growing. Legislation, which in my role as special rapporteur, my office tracks very closely, and we see a number of trends, which the most obvious of which is that these legislative enactments are generally broad, vague, lack legal clarity, and give governments enormous leeway to use CT to do both governance and security work. And it's not by accident that Xinjiang in China has been described as a violent extremism problem. It's not by accident that the new the national security law of Hong Kong is primarily a CT law. All of these things from Egypt to Turkey, but also to Western states who have, in the context of the rise of the caliphate and the challenge of returnees to European states in particular, and the UK is amongst them, have used the opportunity to significantly augment and expand their counterterrorism and security legislation. The second thing I would say about that legislation is it's no longer exceptional. So in the good old days, as someone who grew up and has spent most of her life in Belfast, you had something called the Exceptional Emergency Powers Act, or the PTA, the Prevention of Terrorism Act, which had to be renewed in Parliament every year. So it was really clear this was an exceptional piece of legislation that you had to make the case for keeping. Well, of course, after 1998, the end of the conflict in Northern Ireland, we moved from exceptional counterterrorism law in the UK to just regular counterterrorism law, which is part and parcel of the law of the land without any exceptionality. And that motif of a lack of exceptionality really also frames what we see happening at national level. And the impact of that legislation has been extraordinary. There's an extraordinary NGO called Civicus, which measures the openness of societies around the world. And on their data, we use their data for the purposes of the work I do as special rapporteur. We see 111 countries with severely restricted civic space around the world, with a direct correlation of that shrinkage to the use of counterterrorism and security measures. And more increasingly, we see security as governance, meaning governments find the allure of these of this form of doing its work increasingly attractive. So that's a long road to get us to where we go next, right? So one might have thought, as we hit the end, the 20-year anniversary of 9/11, with the potential for reflection, as well as the fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban, as well as the ongoing affirmation by the monitoring team, the Security Council monitoring team, that the Taliban continues to be closely associated with Al-Qaeda and, in their view, continues to pose a security threat, that we might have a moment where we would have pause and think, wow, has any of this worked? We've had 20 years of counterterrorism in this form. And where are we now? And for those of us who have, both as scholars and practitioners, argued for rethinking of security shrinkage and rethinking, and have decried the way in which, you know, CT functions as a Pac-Man that eats everything up around it, that would be the aspiration. But in reality, I think we're seeing something else. And I'll just briefly describe what we're seeing. We're seeing a consolidation, not a shrinkage, of this architecture. Because even as countries like the United States actually step back from the kind of counterterrorism that they've been doing, at least in one way, counterterrorism, the model of counterterrorism that's been developed post 9/11 has been embraced by countries as diverse as China, Russia, Philippines, Sri Lanka, Honduras, Ethiopia. It's because the framework is enormously permissive, and governments struggling either with legitimacy, democracy, or retention of power have found the tools of CT to be extraordinarily attractive and give enormous cover at the international level to the work that's done. So the architecture is entrenching. The architecture is entrenching because states like Russia and China in particular have an interest now in entrenching it. It serves their domestic interests. We also see that this weakening of the multilateral spaces by outsourcing of CT work to these nebulous informal spaces, maybe as I think other scholars have commented on, a reflection of broader informalities that are undoing the formality of international law. That continues at a pace. I see no evidence of it stopping, because these new informal spaces again serve really important objectives for states. And I think what we're going to see is we also see the ways in which what I have called the datification of counterterrorism increasing. That datification, which is closely bolted to developments in technology, new technologies, means that states have increasingly new tools at their disposal in the counterterrorism arena that are both justified and authorized by Chapter 7 of the Security Council, but also highly convenient to serve domestic governance and security agendas. So the horizon looks increasingly bleak at this 20th anniversary. And let me stop there and take questions from you. Thank you.